Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up, and take it away. Take it away.
Really think that's too long?
Well, this part's too long right there.
Well, it's meant to start talking over it as it fades
right,
down.
Right, well.
Right. It's but not too long.
I think it's too long.
That's not too long.
I think it's
You're going to get hate mail again.
I don't care.
It's not too long.
Who is upgrading their system right now?
It gives us an opportunity to do playful banter. The music is running.
A lot of people hate the playful banter, apparently.
No, I don't know. I get mixed.
Screw them. Let them do their own damn show.
A little defensive there, aren't you?
No, well, yeah, I am defensive. You guys have been reading the emails we've been getting, you know, all these people saying, oh, in order to get more listenership and stuff like that, you guys are going to have to buckle down and edit your content and make a nice podcast out of it.
And lose the playful banter
issues. Yeah, screw you, you know?
Hey,
those are our faithful listeners, man.
They
are faithful. And
take it under advisement.
Right.
I mean, under advice. Yeah. I got a turd over here the size of my arm. They can take that under advisement, too.
And that's why we'll have no listeners soon.
I like this. The Silicon Graphics refrigerator project.
Well, you know, look at it this way.
Silicon Graphics, didn't they go out of business?
We are the show that's going to hold you over till the Linux show gets back on.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. It's right. And then you can go on there and listen to them, and they're all professional. I mean, the audio quality that they had the last time was impeccable.
Well, listen, if we were like other podcasts, you'd get with the program.
But, you know, speaking of crap, I up the restrictions on the forum that you have to respond to, you know.
You're talking about spam?
Yeah, respond to an email before you can actually become a member of the forum. And ever since I did that, spam's increased. It hasn't gone down.
Yeah, I keep seeing that on because I look at the forums through blog lines.
Uh-huh.
You're like scrolling through and all of a sudden you get that like the 50 line of Viagra advertisements there.
Right, and most of the time Pat is taking care of it if I find it during the day.
Unless I'm really busy at work and I can't
or,
get to
you know,
it. I think it's Pat that's putting them in there. That's what I think.
Yes, I have a spam bot sitting in my house.
You know, he follows your posts, Pat. Pat's like talking about, you know, some kind of thing. And next thing you know, the next post is like, yeah, in response to Pat's post, here's 50 sex links, you know?
we all need penis enlargement patches.
Which, you know, it kind of blows me away because prior to initiating that required that you have to respond to an email, there was no restriction. You just signed up right away and we had less spam. And the next step to do is require administrative approval. I don't really want to do that. Because it's a nuisance, but I just can't believe it. But here is an interesting piece of blog spam I got today. Now this is really pushing it. Okay, this is really pushing it. This is good.
Everything except for like one link in it looks like it's a real message.
Right. This is it. I'm going to read it because I was so impressed with it that actually. I'm very very impressed that this sort of work is being done. Web design is getting stagnant with people just using styled block-level elements to produce artwork. The incorporation of SVG in the sites excites me a lot. How long do you expect it will take for this sort of technology to be widespread? Obviously, you can only speak about WebKit realistically, but if it's going to take 10 years for IEWin to gain full support, we can't design with it. I'm amused by the becoming more important line in the first paragraph. This has been a huge problem for years, ever since HTML 2.0 was introduced, to be more of a layout language and less of a markup language. For example, you just have to look at this site, sexpartners.adult-com.
Yeah, that was on, I think, Rasterweb the other day.
Yeah. Why is all the text crammed over to the left side of the page with a big blank space on the right side? Why is the default font tiny and unreadable? Unfortunately, most browsers now let you override the latter prop. That's
impressive.
That is a pretty good spam posting.
That's pretty good, man. Yeah. They had to really work that one, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I deleted it anyway, but I kept a copy of it, the text, because I was impressed with it.
Very impressive.
impressed with
Dan him. Wants to know how to make his spam emails go out and look that good.
Yeah. I don't know.
All the ones that come from the linuxlink.net, right?
Yeah. Well, I like to run my, with a full open relay there. You know what I noticed? Yeah. I didn't realize that by default, Tektronix, where we have the virtual server, installed SendMail on the server.
Oh, yeah.
And it was running, and I believe it was running wide open, because all of a sudden I'm like, we're getting like 600 megs of worth of mail in the logs per week.
Hmm.
And I'm like, so I shut SendMail down, because we don't use SendMail.
Yeah.
And there's no reason to have that thing running. And I was like, wow, right. What the hell?
Well, that sucks.
So we never.
I mean, all this time I could have had a TLLTS.org email address, and I never even played with it.
So we never actually got around to talking about this whole FreeSpire thing. What do you guys think about this whole deal? You think they're unfairly getting treated by the press and people in the community, saying this is just a ploy to get more attention for FreeSpire/Linspire? Or is it a real you know, intent by Linspire to, you know, foster a community?
I think, personally, and, you know, no one gives a shit really what I think, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I think that what they're doing is...
Link's in form tonight.
Yeah. I think that what they're doing is no different nor worse than anything that Red Hat and SUSE have done. So, you know, more power to them.
I don't have a problem.
Who really gives a crap? It's not, you know... I don't think that they're trying to get one over on anybody. I don't think they're trying to be malicious. I think they're pursuing what they think is good and what will ultimately affect their bottom line. You know, their the almighty dollar that they want to make. But you know what? If you can make a buck off of free and open source software, why not? You know, exactly. Everybody's got kids to feed.
Yep, everyone's got a freaking, you know, mortgage to pay and mouths to feed and.
Do you know what I would
like
to see?
I mean, it's not a bad deal, right?
What I would like to see is a combination of FreeSpire with that Novell Forge service that they're offering, where you can upload your source code and it'll create packages for you.
Oh, right, right, for click and run.
Uh-huh.
That kind of thing right there. I would like to see kind of a combination of that would target, you know, all the package systems, but have a nice interface like FreeSpire or Click and Run has. That's a little more, like, Synaptic is nice, but if you would take, you know, FreeSpire has nice little pictures and screenshots and stuff like that, if I'm not mistaken, or the Click and Run does, and, you know, maybe a little more information in there for newbie-friendly and stuff in there that's also for more advanced users, and it would become a nice repository area. Now, I realize that if you're going to support more distributions and you're going to do, like, that Forge-type thing that Novell has, it's going to require a heck of a lot of support, you know, community support, maybe even, you know, commercial support from the distributions. But it has the potential to be something really,
so
really good.
I mean, people bitch to say, oh, you know, what the hell are we going to run FreeSpire for? It's there. Listen, no one's freaking holding the gun to your head to use it. If you don't want to use it, don't use it. They're targeting a different audience than the techie crowd.
My whole point is, like, my big thing here is I want to see people get away from Microsoft.
Exactly.
And if FreeSpire or Linspire or any other Linux or for that matter, any other open source operating system gets them to get away from Microsoft so that we have a little bit more competition and some more open standards and things like that running around, I'm all for it, right? I don't have to be locked into making sure everything is, you know, the GNU way or the free software way. I'm happy just knowing that, you know, it's not Microsoft for now.
You know what I'm concerned about? And I blame Jeremy Garcia for this because I didn't get a chance to talk with Michael Robertson when you did the interview.
I didn't talk to Michael Robertson.
Well, who did you talk to?
Kevin Carmody.
Or Kevin Carmody. Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Kevin Carmody at the Linux World Expo. And what I'm concerned about is I wonder what's going to happen with Linspire's support of FreeSpire or that type of service. Because I look at NVU, and it seems like NVU development has almost like dropped off the face of the earth. I mean, they're still at version 1.0 for over a year now, and it doesn't seem like it's going any further. And you look at Gizmo. I'm not sure when what the deal is with Gizmo, whether they're still putting out more emphasis into it, more development. I don't know when the last version was released. I think it was a little while ago. Is this going to be a project that they just throw out there and then it doesn't get any support and just flops around and eventually dies?
Good question. I don't know. You know, some people saying this is, a little bit of desperation on Inspire's part because they're not making money. Well, if it is, so be it. But, at least they're making an attempt to go at it, People are bitching and crying, you can't get Linux on pre-installed systems. Well, these guys are going out and they're giving it their best shot, man. They're in a no-win situation, basically. People damn them if they do and they damn them if they don't, What are they going to do?
That's right. You know what? As long as they're doing something and it's working towards the ultimate goal, go for it.
Exactly.
Why not? It's not really hurting. You know what? And here's the thing. All the people that are bitching, right? I've seen a lot of them. People crabbing about this and crabbing about that. How much you want to bet and not one of them sons of bitches is actually running FreeSpire or
None of them are.
That's my whole point. You know what I mean? None of them are even running it, so it's not affecting them whatsoever. So shut the hell up, Go back to your freaking fedora or red hat, whatever.
Speaking of fedora, did you say you got SUSE 10.1?
Yeah.
Now, what did you get? What did you download? The DVD?
No, they didn't have the DVD where I pulled it from.
Because I'm running...
It's not officially out until tomorrow, but there is a way of getting it beforehand.
I got RC3 or 2, and what I did was the boot disk install for the
net. I don't know.
Install.
Should I just put the link out there where people can pull it down before the actual official release date? It's basically a server in Japan that's a mirror, and for whatever reason, they didn't block access to it until tomorrow. So anyone could go to the site and pull it down.
People can figure out where it is.
If you go to the OpenSUSE mailing list, the main one, and you scroll down towards the end, you'll see a post about it. It's a Japanese mirror site.
Oh, the dog is up here.
No, it's what, 5 CDs or something like
no,
that?
No, it's if you're going to do it, either English or German, it's 3 CDs. If you want to install all the non-free stuff, like Flash and Java and all that, it's on a separate CD for download. So if you want, if you just want to do a regular install, it's 3 CDs.
But if you want Java and Flash and playing DVDs, you gotta do another one.
Yeah, there's an extra one. But the extra one is platform neutral. It's for all the different platforms they've released. So, and to their credit, they are releasing a PPC version and AMD 64 version.
Now, see, I didn't...
So you have it running already?
I downloaded and burned it yesterday. Today I work late and I really didn't have time to install it. I'm probably going to set it up tonight.
Now, I don't like having to download 5 CDs or 1 DVD or 3 CDs and 1 DVD because I don't have a DVD drive on the machines that I was thinking about installing it on. So I went with the boot.iso option
and did the net install.
And, it took a little while, but I got it on there. I got a pretty slim system. And you know what? While SUSE is nice, and it's really, Yast is really nice to use, it's damn slow compared to everything else.
You know what?
I don't care what anybody says.
It can't be slower than Yum. Yum is freaking molasses, man.
I mean, I go in there.
Well, Yum is depending on which mirror or which site you go to.
I heard the thing with Yum is it doesn't cache any of the information, so every time you do an update, it goes out and checks all the headers all over again. So every time it's slow as shit. But I heard, I was talking to Trolls, and he was telling me that there's this new package manager. It's called Smart. And what it is, it's cross-platform. It runs on most different distributions. And it works with RPMs. It works with Debian packages. You should check it out. Supposedly, he tried setting it up with 10.1. He says it's smoking fast, supposedly. So I'll post the link in a second. Let me just get to it.
But I'll tell you what, whenever I had to do anything on that machine, it's pokey. I pull up Yas and I want to configure my printer and it's got to read all this crap in and, do some initialization crap, and then I get the printer. And for the life, I don't know why, but I can't get the damn thing to print to the printer, even though I have it set up. I just set it up like I did on all my Slackware systems, on my, you know, on OS 10. Everything else, it works fine. But I go over to the SUSE thing, it will not print to this damn printer. And every time I want to play, well, you know what? Actually, it will print a test page, but I can't get any application to print to it, which really blows me away. I'm trying to figure out why. And every time I got to look at this thing, it's got to, like, reinitialize everything in the ass. And when I finally get it up, I just, you know, I'm like, you know, the hell with it.
The hell with it.
The hell with it. I'll dump it to a file, switch it to another machine, and print it off of there. It'll be faster.
Well, I'm going to give SUSE a good running, man. That's the only real distro I haven't tried. And I'm really going to at least give it a month solid just to see how it is. And if it sucks and I don't like it.
A whole month.
Yeah, before at least.
What if it really sucks, though? You know,
at least until Ubuntu comes out, the next version of Ubuntu becomes official.
That's only a couple weeks.
Well, I'm going to give it a run at least. I'm going to see how it is, honestly.
And trying to add repositories to Yast. I wanted to get Java. I don't know why I wanted to, but I just wanted to get Java. For some stupid reason, I wanted Java. And I go in and I read the. Well, this is the repository to add, and I go add the repository. And it says you can't find it. So I'm like, man, this is
the repository there, though.
Pain in, I don't know. But this is the documentation told me to add this repository. I don't know. For some reason, I like SUSE, but I just have like this mental block on using it because it just, some bits of it just annoy me. But it's nice, but it annoys me. But it's like on that edge that it's compared to Arch, compared to Slack, compared to Debian, it's slower. And that just annoys me because I say
because you're used to fast. That's why
everything is slow compared to Slackware.
I like it, but it's just a little too slow. It just annoys me.
Go back to Slack, Dan.
And I'm running Slackware. This on the processor Slackware is like is a gig friend, processor Dan. With a gig of RAM, and
nah,
it shouldn't
Dan
be this
wants
bogey.
To run a modern distribution.
It is a modern distribution.
I'm going to be going back to Slack soon. So,
what are you running there? Ubuntu.
Well, no, I've got Slack on a laptop, but I bought a new hard drive. I bought like a 250 gig.
Me too, man. Drive. What'd you get? Did you get that one was it not Staples? Circuit City.
Circuit City.
Yeah, $80. I got the same one.
Yeah.
Yep.
On it, and I figured I'd try some new things on it. So I got Fedora on there right now, which is all right, but I don't know. It's just not. It's not doing it for me. So I'm going to give it to the end of the week. And
what do you think about the speed of Fedora?
You
What's
know,
the Core 5 you're running.
It's Core 5 on it. It runs really nice. I mean, I have no complaints over, like, you know, like even like OpenOffice fires up really quick on it. But it's just, I don't know, there's just something about it that, I don't know. Maybe I'm just like, you know, guilty because I went away from Slack or something. I don't know.
It's just not Slackware. It's not right.
It's just not Slack, yeah. So I think what I'm going to end up doing is because I really bought the drive just for the Myth storage on it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to partition it in two spots, blow my... copy my original drive over onto it as a backup.
Or you can just do LVM. Have you tried doing LVM?
No, right now, what I'm going to plan on doing, is, like I said, is I'm going to copy the original because I have an 80 gig drive in there now.
Uh-huh.
That's going to be the Slackware and MythBox portion of it, and then the 250 is just going to be all...
Are you familiar with LVM? LVM, basically, you can have multiple hard drives,
yeah,
and it recognizes as one drive, basically.
Yeah, but I'm just going to go back to Slack anyway.
You enjoyed spending 20 hours doing Myth install on Slackware.
No, it's Myth did not take too bad for me. I did try not mix. Now I didn't or not Myth. Excuse me, easy for me to say. I did give that a try on Sunday night on it, but unfortunately it didn't want to work for me.
What happened?
Well, when I installed it, it initially assigns a dynamic address.
Really?
And then during setup. It asked me, do you want a static one? So I was like, yeah, I put a static
because
address on
when,
there.
When I did it, it asked me what was my preference, and I put static in.
Okay, well, I don't. You, maybe I missed that point or something
you're
on
just,
it. But
you're just hitting enter.
No, I wasn't. No, I wasn't just hitting enter. I was reading everything. But you know, I set it up properly for the address on there. But
click
when I booted,
enter.
When it finally booted up,
enter.
Yeah, click. I just had that little like you
side
know,
of
that
I enter. Side of I enter.
Yeah, no, I had that little bird that bounces. You know, just hitting the enter button all day long. No, but you know, I set it up on it and. The config files said it was a static address, but every time I rebooted it, it came up with a dynamic one.
Huh.
So the back end could never find
You could fix that.
Well, I know, but I just was like, it was, you know, 8 o'clock at Sunday night. And so you getting time for bed for me, so I was like, fuck it, and I just said out.
Whoa!
A 30-minute install was too easy for you.
No, and that's what was really nice about it. That was really nice about it. Because, you know, it was nice to actually be able to use the remote.
Yeah, everything was set up.
Yeah, because I never programmed, you know, when I initially set up Myth myself, I didn't program in the
LARC.
Yeah, because I didn't have anything. So I never bothered to actually compile it for that. And I never got around to doing that. So, you know, the Myth, you know, the card you gave me had all the, you know, had the remote and everything. And that was actually nice to be able to use that. But the problem is I couldn't get the back end started. So it never went out and got channels or anything. So I was just like, fuck it. I'm going to come back to it. Because
it's good. Now Myth is fantastic, man. I tried doing an install, and it worked flawlessly for me, man.
Yeah, I am going to go back to it because I do have plans toward the end of the summer to get a dedicated box.
You're going to build a box?
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. I don't really need a fast CPU anymore because the 350 does all the encoding and decoding. So
the first time I set up Myth TV was with that, the Asterisk server, 800 megahertz, and it worked fine.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to find, like a 1 gig machine. Yeah. Probably one of the computer shows or something.
Cheap AMD machine.
Just something that runs and doesn't have to worry about it too much. And then I will actually use that because it was very nice to just drop the disk in and walk away.
Yeah, you can't beat that, man. 30 minutes to set up Myth TV complete, man.
Yeah.
It's sweet. They really did a fantastic job. Speaking of which, the main developer of Not Myth, Cecil Watson, I've been trading emails with him. He's definitely going to be coming on, and we'll be talking to him. It's just a question of nailing down a date. He's probably going to be on in July sometime.
See, the problem is, I listened to your twat, which really annoyed me.
What annoyed you?
That's disgusting.
It makes me want to set up a Myth TV box really bad.
I'm also writing an article, too.
Right. That was a good... I really liked your episode.
It was short, too. It was about 12 minutes.
Yeah, and I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I gotta get me a Myth TV.
It's cheap, man. It's come down in price. You can get the 150 card for about $55.
Right. Now. I gotta do that. I don't know what I'm waiting for.
And hard drives are cheap.
Link.
Yeah.
Yeah. You at that pinball convention, man. You missed it. That was cool.
Oh man.
There was like 75 plus machines easily, all on free play. I was in there for 3 hours. I purposely took the bike up so I didn't come home with a pinball machine.
You know what? Speaking of annoyances this week, this really, yesterday, and this isn't a Linux topic, but maybe we'll have a happy ending sometime in the future. But they had upgraded.
We're going off for ice cream?
Yeah.
That's what I'm not thinking of. I'm thinking of something else.
I'm trying to make up for the F-bombs.
They had upgraded up at our office, all the administrative people, to Office 2003 from Office 2000.
Oh, tell me about it, man.
And we get a call from one of the people who says, I can't send my document as an email attachment anymore. we're running GroupWise, so we go up there. And we're down on a machine. Down. We did it on a test machine, and we had no problem sending as an email attachment. We made sure that the default mail client was set to GroupWise. Everything was working fine. We go up there, and I do all that stuff for her, and it doesn't work. I remove GroupWise. I reinstall it. Still doesn't work. You know, we're sitting there fiddling around with stuff for 2 hours trying to figure out why this isn't working. We're reading stuff to say, well, they change stuff in Office. Things don't work the same way. Things don't, you know, you can try changing these registry settings and all this. In the meantime, the other secretary comes over and says, I can't open my database. Or when she opens her database, she gets all that warning about malicious code or outdated code or some scripts. Do you want to still open it? She opens it up.
Tell me about it, man.
Right. So she finally gets it open because she wrote the damn thing. She clicks on the forms button. Or a report button to bring up a report. Nothing happens. Nothing happens. So we go, we're back down in the test machine. We pull her database over onto a copy of it on our machine. We open up, no problem. So here we can do the mail thing and open the database report.
I got one for you too.
But wait, I'll tell you how this ends, okay? I'll tell you how this ends. After two, three hours of putzing around, okay? What we had to do for the email thing was we had to remove Windows messaging, uninstall it, reinstall our email client, which reinstalled Windows messaging, then it worked. For the database thing, now here's the good one. Here's the kicker. For the database one, we had to switch to a different printer. And then it would open. So then we, when we realized that it was the print driver preventing us from opening the report in Access, we had to upgrade the print driver, and then it would work. But that is freaking
ridiculous. That is the singular dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life.
So ridiculous. And there was no indication. There was nothing in the event logs. There was nothing. Nothing that was telling us that there was a problem. It just sat there and did nothing.
So how did you figure out it was the printer then?
We started going out looking at all different things that could possibly be on the web. And in one forum somewhere, a person had responded and said, okay, try this. You want to close that door, Alan?
Yeah.
Try this. Switch to Microsoft's image viewer in the printers. Switch to that and see if you can open the report. So that's what we did. We replicated that, and it opened. So then we realized that it was that driver, that printer driver. So we tried it to a different printer, and it worked fine.
Isn't it ridiculous, man?
Oh, it is.
At my job, we had a bunch of Access databases that were created under Access 97 going back like 5 years ago. Anyhow, we tried opening up and editing it in Access 2003. You're able to open up the database. You're able to run a macro script to import the file into the database. You're able to export the file out to a text file, but you can't edit the macros. There's no way possible. Someone submitted a ticket to Microsoft. Sorry, shit out of luck. You got to recode the scripts.
Yeah, that's support for you.
Superior Microsoft product. Keep paying them, baby.
Yeah, we had our media specialist was talking to a higher up in the district and said, hey, you know, you really should start looking into this open office stuff. It's, you know, aside from it being free, it runs on all different platforms. And we use it all the time to fix Word documents or Office documents that go awry. You know, it works really great. I can't recommend it highly enough. And his response was, well, I realize that, you know, we're paying all this money for Office, but what I like about Office is I know how to use it. I'm comforted by the fact that I'm paying for something I know how to use. And I'll pay that extra bit of money because it's something I work with and I know that I'm comfortable with it. So, ergo, you know, $65,000+ later, you know, we're there with that comfort.
What are you going to do, man? Yeah. At least it's not your money that's being wasted.
I live in a different... It's taxpayer money.
It's disgusting, isn't it?
It is.
Piece of shit product, man. It is burning money on it.
It is. And I can't wait till the next version comes out, which drastically changes everything.
Yes. Breaks it even more. Just to change gears real quick, I posted on the mailing list, not on the mailing list, in the forums, about Project Orange, which is the world's first open source movie created with Blender. Did you guys see that post by any chance?
Yeah.
Looks cool, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I've been talking to the director, this guy, Bassam Kardali. He's based out of Massachusetts. He's the only American that's on the team, and he's the director of the project, and he's agreed to
which
come on.
Which is why you're talking with him, right?
We're going to be talking to him on the 24th. Now, we originally planned on doing a call-in episode, but this is pretty current. The movie's just coming out now. If you go to the website, you can check it out, and you can actually purchase the video. They didn't have any. The only thing I noticed was they didn't have any preview clips. So if we don't, maybe I'll shoot him another email asking him if they're going to post some preview trailers so we can check it out beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it looks like a really cool project, man. It's a whole movie done in Blender. Really, really impressive looking. So that's the 24th coming up.
Slick.
Yeah, cool stuff, man. Dan, you played with Blender for a bit, didn't you?
Yeah.
You did a presentation at the Lug like last year. Last year or 2 years ago? Or a while back.
No, it was... Yeah, that's where I made
a couple
that
years
Death
ago.
Star scene.
Yeah, you did a Death
it's
Star.
Like 3 years ago, right?
And it took me like a month and a half to do it.
Well, you should check out the Blender.org site, man. Some of the stuff that these guys is awesome. Really impressive looking stuff.
Like, yeah, they have a DVD of movie out now.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, let's just saw that, yeah.
Can you, Alan, can you go over there and take my mouse and move that damn thing up, that slider bar up? Because I don't know why it won't move up here.
It doesn't do anything but it.
Doesn't do it for me either.
There you go.
All
right.
It doesn't do it by touching. You have to actually roll the ball.
There we go. There. Everybody, we're gonna stop transmitting any second now because Dan's screwing with stuff again.
My God, he touched the mouse.
Blab.
Annoys me.
No, this is not Microsoft.
Yeah, that's true. Your mouse has moved. Would you like to reboot?
Should we Skype in our guest?
Yeah, I think we should.
Let's do it.
You're going to have to bump me off to do it, though, aren't you?
No.
Get your hands off of me, you damn filthy ape.
Wait, why is it ringing for him? What the?
I didn't touch anything.
Why would it be ringing? It's not what I want.
So some people have mentioned...
Mine says security monkey ringing over here.
Some people bitch that the latency when our VoIP calls is too much. They can't deal with it. They're asking us to edit the sound file so we can get rid of those little latency things.
What are you talking about?
Are you calling him? I'm going to drop off real quick.
No, you don't have to drop off. I can conference him in.
All right, well, try now because he was calling me.
Can you right-click on him, Alan, and choose conference? Because I don't know why. Is it not working?
Nope.
So I think you got to initiate it with both parties at the same time.
No, there's something screwy. You know what? It's because I'm using...
There's something screwy because, like, nothing works over here. Which is nothing out of the ordinary for us.
Yep. All right. Try it now.
It's not working.
There we go.
Select conference in.
And maybe this will be it.
Maybe.
Right, Monkey something. Incorporated.
Hey, how you doing today?
The monkey.
I'm here.
Excellent.
We're starting to get a complex.
Yeah, no. Pat kept rambling on, and then Alan had some junk to say, and they wouldn't shut up, so now we got you on.
Yeah. Great.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can hear Monkey. You.
All right, this is Link. I'm on the other side. So,
all right, we have a really special guest tonight, Security Monkey. You might know him from the popular weekly podcast with Leo Laporte, Security Now, and he's the author of Spin Right, yes?
You know, even I can't sound that geeky, man. Come on.
No, you have a fantastic, fantastic blog. And you had a fantastic podcast, and I've been waiting for the next episode for the longest time.
Had. Listen to this stuff.
Yes, you and all of the hate mail I've been getting lately,
right.
Yes. Yeah, I apologize for the lack of podcasts. I've been really busy. The first 6 months of the year is my go time. And, you know, I have it recorded. I just haven't done the post-production on it. But I'm going to try to get to that before this weekend, hopefully. So
post-production be damned.
You don't know anything about that, do you, Link?
No. No, they're just mad because I'm not on your podcast again. See, that's what it is.
Ah, well, you know, you're welcome to come back anytime.
With his conspiracy theories.
That's right. Yes, we're going to find out who is the true Steve Gibson, apparently. So.
Yeah. He's running IIS with a bunch of assembler patches, right?
That's right.
Like, what the frig is he thinking, man?
You know, and he has a 4,096-bit PGP key, so...
I guess security through obscurity, man.
That's right.
Because I don't think anybody knows how to do assembler anymore. It's pretty much... It's a dying art, man. It really is. Not too many people know how to read that stuff.
No, I think I forgot that after 3 months after leaving college. Let me see here. All right, I finally have the website up, and I have my notes in front of me now. Okay, I'm ready to go.
Awesome.
All right, I'm going to do a Dvorak. Next topic!
Well, I'll tell you what. When we were chatting back and forth in the email, you said you were... now I lost my email. You said one of the things that you wanted to discuss was Roscoe.
Yes, my good old friend Roscoe. Roscoe is kind of this, he's practically a character in a lot of the case files on the blog, which I'm going to do another Dvorak, and I'm going to actually plug the blog at blogs.ittoolbox.com/security/investigator. Got to get the plug in.
We'll bleep that out in the,
yeah.
Post for the doc.
Man, you're just like Leo. Yeah. Now, Roscoe is sort of a reoccurring character. He's not actually a human being. He's a forensic workstation that he's actually gone through numerous revisions over the years, but he gets dragged with me all over the place. More so a while ago than now, since I have a corporate gig and I don't really do a whole lot of investigative consulting anymore. But for those that aren't in the business, and when I say a forensic workstation, they're like, nothing like what you see on CSI. A forensic workstation, if you can imagine for a moment, going into the world of Security Monkey, is if you can imagine a small form factor PC put into a military ballistic grade case, which doesn't protect it from getting beaten up. If you read my case files, you'll know the inside joke there. But he's basically a small form factor PC. He has a lot of really cool forensic tools installed on him, things like Encase from Guidance Software, Forensic Toolkit, lots of other applications, which I can mention in a little while here. As far as hardware goes, you know, he's just I think his latest incarnation. You know, he's a P3 1 gigahertz box. He's got a slave IDE cable that I can whip out at any time and tack onto a write blocker, and then tack onto an IDE drive so I can do forensic images of the drive in place. And a lot of the field analysis work actually occurs on Roscoe. Now, Link was saying, well, you know, you got to give the listeners some pictures. So, you know, the closest thing you're going to find to Roscoe on the web is if you go to forensic-computers.com. And I can, as we go there, I can point you to a great example of what one looks like. So on the front page there, you'll see two workstations sort of sitting side by side. Of course, the images change, so I could be lying. But one of them is called a Forensic Airlight 3. Sounds pretty nifty. That is an excellent example of what a Roscoe looks like. And that's pretty close to the price of a Roscoe. They're not cheap. On the website now, they have them listed for about $4,000. And I want to point out that that $4,000 is simply hardware, construction, packaging, you know, some documentation, and some phone support, which is excellent, by the way. And you get a one-year warranty. But these, you know, this isn't your everyday PC. These things are made to take a beating. They're made to run, you know, in hot climates. I've used this thing everywhere from, you know, a nice cushy hotel room to, you know, blazing hot desert environment. I've used it in outside environments. Believe it or not, kind of hard to see the screen, but it works. So, you know, it's really the best all-around tool if you're going to do field investigative work on PCs. And something else, I'm going to actually mention this in my blog so you get kind of a preview, but one of the things I'm going to mention shortly is that a lot of the field forensic work that is being done now by people lugging around these forensic you know, boxes like I have, you know, shortly we're going to kind of be these little nomads. We're sort of going to be the exception and not the rule because of products like Guidance Software has this really cool product called Encase Enterprise Edition, which lets corporate administrators, security personnel, remotely image machines while they're turned on remotely. And the user, you know, is unaware most of the time that's going on. Usually, you know, you try to do it before or after hours. But there's no more going to the PC and tearing it apart and grabbing the hard drive. Now it's just you've got a client pre-installed on these workstations. And you grab the image remotely, and you work on the image file separately. And that kind of brings me into another topic along the same lines, and that is some of the software that you might find on Roscoe. And if any of you guys have questions, just jump in. I'm blazing through my notes here to keep everyone entertained. Some of the products that you'll find, a lot of it is open source stuff, and there is some commercial oddities thrown in there. I like a good hex editor. Right now, you know, Roscoe is really a, he's a Windows 2000 box simply because the version of Encase Forensic Toolkit that I use are Windows-based. However, I do use a lot of Linux boot CDs, and my favorite one, which I brag about all the time, is called STD, which is not a sexually transmitted disease. It stands for Security Tools Distribution, and you can grab that at s-t-d.org. And, you know, just about every tool that I can think of off the top of my head is on this bad CD. I love this thing. It's got encryption tools, forensic tools, firewalling tools, honeypots, IDS, network utilities, password crackers. It has some server daemons, packet sniffers, TCP tools, tunneling tools. Anything that you're going to need to go in and do an assessment or do some type of investigative work is probably on that
CD. Can I ask a really dumb question, though?
I probably have a really dumb answer.
All right. I'm sitting here looking at this forensic workstation.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking to myself, like, what the hell do you need that thing for? You know, is this just like so you can look cool and carry a Sherman tank around on your arm or what? You know, I mean.
Now, evidently, you haven't been watching CSI, man. That's all about how cool you look, right? Because we know every forensic laboratory and every law enforcement agency across America looks like that, right?
Oh yeah,
I doubt.
Sure. They all walk around wearing Giovanni suits and shit like that.
Yeah, you know.
Excuse me, one second, Link. Can you post that link in the forum?
The forensic computers.
Yeah.
All right. Let me.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Too.
Now.
Your little
there
love
it is.
Fest.
Well, right. to answer Link's question, you know, these workstations are primarily meant for an investigator that's been called to go out in the field where, equipment may not be readily accessible to you. Like, for instance, a lot of companies, especially smaller companies, they don't have a data security department. They don't have a security monkey walking around who happens to have a Roscoe in the closet. this is more or less to make sure you have all of the tools, all of the equipment in one box that you can take with you. You can go to the workstation or workstations in question. You can do the acquisition. And in most cases, you can do the analysis and get some type of quick report back to the person who hired you.
Right.
And, you know, you have to play by the rules of evidence and everything. Obviously, you have to follow procedures, tag and bag everything. And, you know, you have to keep everything sanitary. So this way, at least you can...
What does this give you that a laptop and a live Linux CD doesn't give you?
Well, in this case, with this model of workstation, it gives you a platform where no matter what you run into, if you run into a machine with an IDE drive, with a SCSI drive, FireWire, USB, this thing has uh-huh. ports and acquisition tools and cables, and I mean, for everything. This is sort of the jack of all trades. And I have to tell you, before I invested in Roscoe, I cannot tell you how many runs to CompUSA and to Fry's Electronics that either I or my buddy Scrap that I mentioned in my blog, you know, we were literally running out all the time. We get to, the hodgepodge of machines that people have in offices, especially
right.
smaller companies. So you go in and the member of management or the investigator on site would say, okay, we need to image these three machines. And, you know, sure as heck, you'd have two machines that were IDE, one would, you know, have 80-pin SCSI. I mean, you just never knew what you were going to walk into. So this sort of helped us out with that, with having all of the adapters and it's relatively quick and easy and painless. It's all in one place. You don't have to make any phone calls and say, hey, can you FedEx me out this adapter?
What happens when you run into a case where, like, you have to go and investigate a security investigator who has a forensic AirLight 3. That's what I want to know.
Well, yeah, you know, you treat it just like any other case, and I have to tell you, I have been called to do to have go in behind another investigator, and I have been called to to investigate the doings of security and privacy personnel who may have not had the company or employee's best interests at hand.
Uh-huh.
And I have to tell you, this may be a big surprise to some and not so much to others, but you know, the people that enforce security and privacy within an organization typically have the sloppiest security practices on their own machines. It just kills me. You know, I've got, and don't get me wrong, I've gone into places where guys have been sharp, and I mean, all of their stuff has been PGP encrypted, and they're, you know, they zero out all the unused sectors of their hard drives before they go home every night. And then I've walked into places where, you know, the guy's running, you know, Windows 98, you know, on a fat file system, no screensaver, no encryption, nothing. So, you know, like I said, if, just when you think you've seen everything, you know, tomorrow I'll show you something else. Never fails.
But now that you brought that up, right?
And
I know you're probably going to want to get back into your other topic, but this is a perfect foray. I know that, and like you and I, over our normal correspondence, have had this topic pop up once to twice. What really is a good, not just a reasonable, but a good level of security for informationaholics like ourselves to be practicing these days?
Well, it depends on how much of a paranoid penguin you are, to steal a column name from Linux Journal. Yes, I do read Linux Journal religiously. You know, to be honest with you, if you stick with a minimum of something like, you know, 128-bit encryption, and you have a decent passphrase, and when I say decent, I mean you've got some really random characters in that passphrase. And not to plug Steve Gibson, but he actually really does have a cool tool on his on his website where you can go and he has this random phrase generator, and you pick the bit length, and it gives you this huge string that you can, you know, you can keep in, you know, text file somewhere on a USB keychain or something, and copy and paste it every time you're wanting to encrypt and decrypt it. Steve's insane. I love the guy, but he's insane. he really is. So, you know, stick with at least a minimum of 128. I tend to use a minimum of 1024, just because I'm a little bit more paranoid than the normal penguin. And you know, use the encryption facilities within your operating system. Just to give you an example, everybody knows I'm a Mac head. I run Tiger on my MacBook, on my G5, And, you know, I use the operating system's built-in encryption features. I turn File Vault on. I have an insane passphrase. I periodically go through and let Disk Utility, you know, zero out. I actually use a 7-pass zero on all of the unused sectors on my hard drive. I do that like once a week. And you know, when I need to ship somebody something, I make a nice encrypted disk image using this utility and send it off to them. So, and that's just using the Mac OS. With Linux, God, there's, you know, hundreds of different utilities that you can use to do the same thing.
Now, what is this stuff really, really necessary though? Like, for like your basic user, like I might have, I don't know, a few files here and there on my computer, some email, you know,
right,
stuff like that. Do I really have to worry about making encrypted volumes of my file system and, you know,
yeah,
256-bit encryption on my email and crap like that?
Right,
is
yeah.
That
do
really
I have
necessary?
To use an encrypted swap partition and all that fun
yeah.
stuff? Which, oh, yeah, by the way, I use an encrypted swap partition. you know, it depends on your risk. What's your risk level? It's like anything else in security. You kind of got to do your little self-assessment and say, what are my risks? Am I at risk from, let's just say, like, if you're living in an apartment and you have a roommate that you're not so sure of, and you guys happen to share a computer, you know, hey, it happens. So at that point, I may say, well, you know, I don't really want him looking at my checkbook records. I don't want him looking at my private documents, my letters.
My porno collection. Yeah.
And yeah, I was just going to say my porn collection. You know, I mean, you got to take that 60 gigs of goodness and protect it, right? So,
right.
So absolutely, at that point, you think, well, okay, how savvy is my roommate? Is he savvy enough that he's going to throw some type of a brute force rainbow tables attack at my file? If he is, all right, well, maybe you want to kick up the strength of your encryption and make sure your passphrase is really insane and memorize it, or, you know, write it on a piece of paper and eat it after you've memorized it. Although I don't recommend post-it pads because they kind of stick through. Not that I've done that, but, you know, and I mean, if it's just a matter of, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, you're taking your, you know, your chances with, like, say, you know, a coworker, for instance, maybe you want to exchange files in a secure manner. Let's say you're co-owners of a company and you do a lot of teleworking. Yeah, maybe you want to kick the bit strength up a bit on that. But you know what? If you're in an environment where everybody loves each other, you have no fear, you have, you know, minimum controls on your workstation, like, you know, a password, you keep adequate backups, yeah, maybe you feel that your risk level warrants using encryption. So my best answer that I give everyone, even when I go into to do security risk assessments, is what's your risk? Tell me. And then I can give you a fair assessment. That was probably the long-winded version of the answer you wanted. But
we got a question for you. One of the listeners wanted to know, in your opinion, what is the most safe operating system by default with no patches or nothing?
Oh, I knew this was going to come up. Well, I can tell you right off the bat, it's not made by Microsoft. You know, it's kind of up in the air right now between, in my opinion, Mac OS X Tiger and a lot of the Linux distros that are out of there. Remember in the old days, Linux distros, they used to, when you install them, every daemon was installed, everything was turned on, you know, you were listening on all ports, and now the community's really come together and made an effort to go with the model that if you don't turn it on, we're not turning it on. So I would very easily put Linux and Mac OS X on par right now as far as out of the box. I'm going to give the edge to Mac OS X simply because out of the box, 10 by default, like a consumer install, has, you know, nothing turned on. So, whereas, you know, Linux, on a lot of the recent distros, you know, you may have a safe server startup. Maybe, you know, SSHD starts up, and hopefully it's a recent version. Hopefully it's a recent distro. But I'd say it's up in the air between Linux distros and Mac OS X.
What about OpenBSD? That's always touted as...
Ooh! Open well, you BSD? Know, I was going to... I was gonna be a penguin here and plug the Linux. OpenBSD is another one of those where they're pretty rock solid, man. I mean, you know, you install it and you turn things on as you use them. They got a really good record. I can't argue with that. Was the question directed more towards workstation or server? Because I was kind of leaning towards your typical workstation.
Yeah, I think it's workstation.
Okay. I don't think a server would qualify because, you know, like you mentioned, most of these operating systems install with nothing running. So,
right.
You know, if you're talking about a server, nothing running isn't a server. So.
Yeah, but you know, the bottom line is it all comes down to the user in the end. To be quite honest with you, I've seen people screw up OpenBSD installs badly. if you're a real seasoned user, like I'm sure a lot of your listeners are, I mean, you could practically take any operating system, you know, update it, install it, configure it, lock it down, and it'll be rock solid. But the user is always that one unstable element. You just never know what they're going to do, what they're going to turn on, what they're going to disable. I don't, you know, want to lay all the blame on the user, but man, they cause so many problems for themselves. And that is why the Geek Squad makes so many millions of dollars a year.
Have you joined the Geek Squad?
Yeah. The little guys that drive around the Volkswagens?
Yeah. Did you finally give up your day job to make more money with the Geek Squad?
No, but you know, I use them as target practice on the road, though. I drive a semi-large vehicle, so I like to come up behind them and make them feel intimidated at my large girth. But anyway,
I do that too, but I do that outside of the car.
He runs up on them naked.
That's right.
Intimidated
at my large girth.
Oh, somebody pass the monkey the brain brush, please.
We had a question from Jordan from Dayton, Ohio. He says, "Security Monkey, currently I'm running a small Apache server at home on Fedora Core 3, and I'm getting annoyed by a lot of traffic I've been getting, mostly buffer overflow attempts and hex, tons of blocker hacking attempts, which I'm not running anyways. Is there anything like deny host script for SSH that would work for blocking these hacking attempts? Are there any other concerns I should look for? I've got all the ports blocked, saved the SSH port that I use regularly when not at home."
Port sentry, change your port numbers, right?
Yes, change your default SSH port, right? That's probably the first step.
Yeah, that would be my first response. I actually did that on all of my servers that I have deployed remotely, and my hack attempts went from several hundred a month to zero. I mean, honestly, I can't even tell you the last time that somebody's knocked on my SSH port on any of my boxes.
I just did that recently, and mine went from several hundred a day to zero.
Wow. Yeah, well, you must be in a really...
It is annoying. Day.
Are you in a popular net block or what? I must be in a boring net
block.
Well,
I just moved to RCN cable modem. But ooh, they've been hitting me for like years. They've been hitting me on DSL too, so...
And when I figure out what port he's going, those several hundred will start again.
That's all right. There are plenty more ports I can move to. That's all right.
Oh, that's great. I think part of the other question, too, one of the very simple things that I've done is I sort of go with the deny all, allow some, using IP chains right off the bat, because you'd be amazed at how many people, if you have to run Secure Shell on the default port, and there are some of you out there, and you know you only access it from three boxes in the world, why even give anyone the opportunity to make a connection to your Secure Shell daemon? So I lock it down right away with that.
All right. And, of course, you should always allow root to log in through SSH.
Yes, always run as root.
Okay, if I have to say that, I'm going to start getting a little worried. Never allow root logins. Oh, and my best piece of advice ever is, you know, don't use password authentication. Please.
So you're all...
Well,
forward.
I guess I'm pretty insecure then, huh?
Well, you know, with
I
a lot
use
of
a non-standard port,
but
I allow root logins, and you know, I use password authentication.
And have an account with test.
Yeah.
Or spam, or
that one I don't have. Yeah.
Admin.
Admin. Or admin Link password, or root password, root.
That's right. Root, Link root. Lives on the edge.
I'm living on the edge, baby.
That's right. He's Danger Man.
My edge is pretty damn safe, though. You know, the last time I was hacked was. Dude, when did we
Two
first
start
the lug, Dan?
What?
When did we first start the lug?
About
how many
six,
years ago
six,
was that?
7 years
99?
Ago.
Seven. It's like 7 years ago. I was hacked once, like 7 years ago, because I was running, and this is on a dial-up connection, believe it or not. I was running a dial-up all weekend, downloading an ISO file so that I could get away from Red Hat. Mm-hmm. And I had a Red Hat Linux box up running with a wide open telnet and a user account of test with a password of test. And I got hacked.
Yikes.
And, of course, there's nothing on my box. I don't even know why they bothered, but I got hacked, and then I downloaded the rest of my ISO and just blow the whole damn thing away anyway, so piss on them.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't had anybody touch me since, so.
That's a great thing to mention, too, especially if you work in the Windows world. If you have a compromised box, you know, if you don't have data on that box that is, you know, going to be life-changing or is worth a lot of money, you know, hey, back up what you can. Obviously, you're going to want to make a backup at some point for reference, but wipe the box and start over. I have seen people sit in boxes for 7 to 8 hours to try to clean, you know, malware, rootkits, Trojans off of their box, and only to have them come back, you know, the next morning, and then they're sitting there scratching their heads going, I don't get it, I cleaned it off. One of the most devious things that I've run into, I talked about this in the blog a couple times, is kernel module backdoors. And those will give you a headache like nothing else. Because most of the time we're just so used to looking for active processes running on the Linux box. Say, oh, look, there's an IRC, you know, there's an IRC relay. Oh, there's a hidden FTP server on my box. And, you know, we have tools to kind of figure that out. Well, very few people think, hey, I wonder if I got a rogue kernel module loaded. So something to keep in mind there. I'm sure everyone's now in a panic. Oh, my God, when's the last time I listed my modules? But and, you know, we have a lot of the binaries get Trojan too. So, you know, if you got a faulty LS mod or other commands. I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Have you ever had a chance to check out AppArmor? It's pretty common in some of the newer Linux distributions. Basically, what it does, it insulates applications to only certain services running on that box.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now that comes with OpenSUSE now, right?
Yes,
it does.
Is that the same?
And
okay,
I think Fedora Core 5 has it, too.
Sweet. Yeah, I haven't actually used that in a production or test environment yet, but SUSE is on my next list of stuff to look at, and I remember reading about that, but I have not used it.
How would you detect backdoor kernel modules?
That's the fun part. There are some tools that people have written to do that because, like I said, a lot of the binaries get Trojan on the box right away. And if all of your module tools are Trojaned, yeah, good luck trying to detect that module. And I'm trying to – Link, was it you – that was telling me that you actually had this happen to you at one point, or was it someone that you knew? Because one of them was they had a case where they actually had Trojan binaries, all their binaries.
I did have Trojan binaries, but the way that I found mine was I went in after I got hacked, and I did a process list. And what had happened is when they applied a rootkit on my system. When they did that, the PS command that they put in there used the BSD style process list and not the System 5 style process list.
Okay.
And I just happen to know the difference because I run both. And I thought it was odd that I did PS -EF on a Red Hat box and it told me I was crazy, you know, and I had to do PS -AX in order to get the actual process list. So I knew something was screwed up. I don't know what else they replaced on there. I'm assuming that you know, probably a lot of the ESPN processes, ESPN programs were replaced.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I just wiped the whole damn box. I'm real paranoid like that. I'm one of those guys that if I even suspect that a system has been compromised, I don't keep anything except maybe, you know, a few documents if I have to, and I just wipe it and start new.
Yeah, I always talk about prevention in a lot of the presentations that I give because you'd be surprised at the number of people that still, in a production environment, don't run good baseline tools like your tripwires. You know, right. It's going to be really obvious if somebody somehow exploits some type of a service on your machine and they install a bunch of Trojan binaries. You know, tripwires, you know, one of the best tools out there, you're going to know, whoop, hey, this binary changed. This is probably not good. That's a good way of getting to the server before more evil doings go on. One of the most aggravating cases that I had seen was that, and I wrote about this in my blog, was at a university. You know, their DNS servers were just plagued with Trojan after Trojan after Trojan. And it was a lot of college kids setting up peer-to-peer stuff, a lot of IRC daemons and whatnot. And, you know, the poor administrators were pulling their hair out because they were trying to reinvent the wheel. They were trying to write shell scripts to run in cron, you know, to detect changes in a lot of the files, like, for instance, anything that had to do with bind. Right. And I said, why are you guys reinventing the wheel? Just install Tripwire. You know, you've already reinstalled the OS three times. You might as well put Tripwire on it next. And, hey, why don't you update your version of bind so you stop getting hacked? But anyway, that goes back to the user being their own problem.
Well, you know, talking about prevention here, and one of the things that we're looking at when we're struggling with is how much prevention is worth it. How much prevention is good when you know, you finally sit back and you look at too much prevention frustrates users and makes it difficult for them to use some of the applications they need to use, and in situations where they must use the application, you got to poke a hole in that prevention.
Right. Yeah, that comes down to our risk assessment methodology again, to use one of the terms that I like to use in a lot of my assessment reports. But, you know, if you're working in a high security environment, you're going to be stuck with high security requirements, period. And anyone that's worked for the Department of Defense, federal government, knows what I'm talking about. There's really no way around it. Finding that fine line between inconvenience and something that you can show the user as being a benefit, as being secure, that is what we're all trying to do. And a lot of it is, there's a lot of playing it by ear, but it's a lot of training and a lot of feedback. You have to explain to the user what it is you're trying to accomplish and why it is that they can't have root on your server and why it is that they can't run a certain daemon on the server. You know, why they can't have, BitchX and a number of other, clients on the server. After you explain it to them, you know, the next step is to get feedback from them and say, well, I understand why my pass, you know, code has to be 8 characters long, but, you know, my problem is I have too many passwords to remember. So at that point, then you're like, well, hey, maybe I ought to look at implementing some type of secure directory function, maybe think about some type of single sign-on, maybe think about using some other form of authentication. So I think the places that have really been successful in figuring out how much security is too much is the ones that have interacted the most with the users, gotten their feedback. And I hate focus groups, believe me. I think focus groups are evil beyond all things. They are evil. Things done by committee usually just go south quick. But if you keep the groups very, very, you know, small, and you have a lot of like little diverse groups to get one-on-one feedback from users, you'd be surprised at just how effective it is at finding that middle line. And again, that's just what I've encountered.
You know what I think is really effective as far as user security? Like, you ever been to a farm? I'm sure some of you guys have been to a farm. You ever been to a farm and you see them big yellow ear tags that cattle are wearing? If you put them on your users, you know, because it's a painful process, right? If you put them on your users, generally speaking, nobody else is going to want to have that and be sporting it around because it's not fashionable anymore. So that's what I was thinking.
You're going to put scarlet eyes on everybody for idiots?
That's right, yeah.
The sheeple.
No, here's a legitimate question, right? I want to ask you. Are you familiar with the HIPAA regulations that they have out now?
Unfortunately, yes. Security and privacy.
Yeah. All right. Now, just say, for instance, that I happen to know of such a scenario as I'm going to describe somehow. Just okay. Say that there's a company, and that they do insurance work that requires them to, you know, fall under the current HIPAA guidelines. And this company does things like no passwords, and running wide open on Windows and on a shared directory server where they happen to move not only the files around, but the directory structure around consistently. And they want to have, like, IRC and, you know, open web access and stuff like that. What would you say to a company like that?
I would say that I hope that since they are a covered entity, per the definition of HIPAA, since they're a payer, I hope to God that they don't have some type of information theft. Well, no, take it beyond that. I hope they don't have a case where information is stolen or misused, because the minute that one of their customers gets wind that their information was stolen from this payer, they're going to contact the Office of Civil Rights, which is the enforcement bureau, you know, of HIPAA. They take all the complaints. And once a complaint has been filed, the government is obligated to investigate. And typically what they do is they contact the payer and say, you know, Joe Schmo has, you know, inquired as to this and this. And then the payer has to come back and say, you know, well, we've done this and that and that. Well, typically the places that have the lax security don't do too well on those responses. Or they answer in a way, you know, that the next thing you know, the Office of Inspector General is crawling around, you know, the payer's office. And, you know, those guys are very by the book. You know, they they have the regs under one arm, and they like to quote FISCAM all day and night. And they will show no mercy when they come in.
Okay,
and,
now, let's just say, for instance, right, and this is all hypothetical, understand?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say, for instance, that there happens to be an IT person working at this particular hypothetical company with these hypothetical security problems that mm-hmm. wants to cover his hypothetical hind end. How would he go about hypothetically doing that, hypothetically?
Well, I'll tell you what. Let me tell you a little story about a payer that I'm pretty familiar with. Who it was in the news. I won't name their name, but you'll all figure it out as I talk about it. But they did a lot of claims work for the federal government, specifically the Department of Defense. Now, the way the story goes is that they had a CIO who was very, very intelligent, very pro-IT, obviously, and very pro-security. Well, as these regs came down, the CIO said, you know, we're not in compliance with a lot of these. We don't have the necessary, you know, technical, you know, administrative safeguards that HIPAA security requires. So this is what we need to do. And he outlaid a plan to the CEO, and the CEO looked at it and went, you know, that's a lot of money. I don't think we want to do that. Well, as we go further into the future, this story, what happens is these people had a break-in, and equipment was stolen containing the records of a metric buttload. That's actually a metric weight right there. A metric buttload of Department of Defense individuals' information. The feds descended on this payer like angry African bees on a you know, guy with you know, no muscle control. I mean they were all over this place. And of course, you know, the fact that the CIO had made all these recommendations, that was all lost somewhere mysteriously.
Right.
And you'll never guess who got canned.
Yeah.
The CIO or the CEO? Who wants to make a guess? Who wants to who wants to play suit Jeopardy?
CEO.
The CIO was asked to resign.
There you go.
He was the fall guy.
So much for taking responsibility in your organization.
Exactly. So I'm going to tell this hypothetical person that Link is talking about here is that you have to look at who the responsible party is within this you know, the covered entity themselves, the payer, they're responsible. And the hypothetical person here works for the payer.
Right.
What it will come down to is if the payer does get investigated, then the payer is going to come down on their IT staff and say, okay, why don't we have this and why don't we have this? Now, at this point, you can do one of two things. You can say, I told you so, and produce a report or a memo, which that will probably make them angry because that shows that they didn't do anything on the recommendation. Or you can go, I don't know, and do the Scooby-Doo reaction, and you'll probably get to work there another 20 years and retire.
Right.
So, yeah, I tell people to look at the scenario. If it is a win scenario, if you know that if you can write up a memo and that your executive management is serious about cracking down and being compliant, then I say go for it. You know, be the innovator in the shop. You know, be the guy carrying the big old clue banana and start whacking people in the head with it. But do it with management's blessing. Because unfortunately, as much as I would like to tell everyone, geeks of the world, rise up and secure your systems and screw the man and screw the suits and do the right thing, a lot of those geeks are probably going to lose their job by doing that. And it's a sad reality. I hate to rain on everyone's parade, but I've been in a lot of companies and talked to a lot of security staff, and I got to tell you, a lot of them are afraid. They're afraid. They do what they can to meet the security regs that are placed upon them, but they, in the end, have to answer to the user. And a lot of the times, the user is senior management, and senior management is usually the signature on the paycheck every 2 weeks. So, again, in long-winded form, I would say, depends on the scenario, and may the force be with you.
Not good.
Oh, boy.
Not good. So, there's been a lot in the past couple of, about past 2 months, there's been a lot of news in the press about, hey, OS X, Linux. What the hell was that?
Now that was cool.
That was Lumberg.
Yeah. There's been a lot of in the press and in security consultants coming up and saying, hey, you know, these Linux machines, these OS X machines, they're really not as secure as people think they are. Here we're having proof of concepts come out. And if they do gain, you know, the reason why the majority of them are secure is because they're just not popular enough for the crackers and the exploiters to take advantage of. I mean, what's your opinion on that?
Oh, yes, the old 3% argument. 3% is not worth anybody's time. I, on the side of my many side jobs, I've actually been participating in the group of people that are working really hard at analyzing the security of the OS X platform and really looking to see what the vulnerabilities are. And they're tracking a lot of the reported, you know, viruses, Trojans, whatever you're reading about in the media. I've been a Mac OS X user since 10.0, when I fell in love with Mac OS X. And Apple had this idea when they went from the classic operating system, which ended with 9 to go with operating system 10. They had this idea of building something secure from the ground up. You know, they started with, you know, the solid, mock kernel and threw Darwin on top and woo, look how pretty and safe it is. Well, now in doing so, yes, they did, unbeknownst or maybe known to them, include some very old, local vulnerabilities in the system, you know, certain commands that, that can do, acceleration of privileges. You know, you could have a user run a specific buffer overflow and gain root, for instance. So there's a few of those out, and Apple's been pretty quick about patching those. The difference here is this, is that Apple was really serious when they designed this, that they wanted to make a platform that you could plug into the internet and not have to worry about being port scanned, rooted, owned, and member of a bot network, you know, in 14 minutes. Okay. So they, I think from the ground up, Apple did it the right way. And I was really hoping Microsoft was going to do that with Vista, but, you know, so much for that. Anyway, did I just give an opinion? I shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
So a lot of, based on that background, when you look at the Austin, you know, Trojans and viruses, these sort of, you know, case studies, these test scenarios that people have come up with, unfortunately, all of them have run into a problem, and that is they rely on the user to do something stupid, because OS10 makes it kind of hard for things to propagate on the system. There's a lot of authentication between you and, you know, installing an application outside of your home directory, for instance. You know, you're boxed into your home directory. Even if you're an admin user on a Mac OS10 box, you're not really an admin user. You can do certain things with preferences, but the minute you try to go outside your home, you have to authenticate. You know, if you want to drag an application and put it into something the system owns, you're going to have to authenticate. You want to install a program, you're going to have to authenticate. So they did that right. As far as you know, the platform itself, I think what you're going to see happen is as Mac OS X gets more popular, you're going to see a lot of these underground efforts to exploit what holes OS X does have. I mean, those are going to increase. And I'm going to say that, one, because the first person that really writes, you know, a Sasser, or that writes a Melissa or whatever for OS X, I mean, they're going to gain a lot of notoriety with their peers, with the underground, and, you know, they're going to probably do 57 months in prison too. But so there's a lot of desire out there to see, okay, who's going to do it? Who's going to find that magic hole in OS X and prove that Mac OS X is no more secure than Windows? So you got that component, of course. Frankly, with the rate that Apple is developing OS X, I mean, you know, we're going to be jumping from Tiger to Leopard here, you know, real soon, hopefully before 2007. You know, I kind of worry, all right, well, you know, they're developing pretty fast, and we all know with, you know, rapid cycle development, you know, bugs can creep in pretty quick. But I'm looking at Apple's track record going, okay, maybe not. Honestly, I really don't think that Mac OS X is going to ever have the exposure or the, I guess you could say the girth of vulnerabilities that Windows has had, just simply from a design standpoint and from the way that the user interacts with the system. I think, in my opinion, one of the things that Windows has to its detriment is that they try to integrate way too many things together. And any of you that are Windows developers know what I'm talking about. It's amazing what you can do. Yeah. It's amazing what can happen when you get you know, a nice exploit in Internet Explorer that you can take advantage of. You know, when you can write to local file systems, where you can change registry settings, when you can own the box through a web browser. That's astounding. And I like I said, I'm crossing my fingers and hoping that the next version of Safari that is released with Mac OS X takes, and Safari, for all you non-Mac OS X people, that's the default browser that comes with OS X. I hope they continue to lock it down, and I hope that they continue to require a lot more user interaction, and they keep all of the warnings up. you know, to let users know, yeah, there is a risk of what you're doing. Are you sure you want to do it? And not just do it like what happens in Windows. And again, you know, and I, to Microsoft's benefit here, they're making attempts. They're doing it in baby steps. Windows Server 2003 is a lot different than Windows Server 2000 or especially Windows NT4. They're trying, but it's baby steps. They're a great big monolithic mountain trying to move fast in the security world, and I don't see it happening too quick for Microsoft.
So what? How do you feel about the Linux then? Because you spoke a lot about OS X. I mean, do you feel the same way about Linux, or do you think it's probably not, you know, we still have a little further to go than comparing it to OS X?
Well, you know, Linux shares a lot of the great design features, right? I mean, you know, by default, you know, we throw the user as a non-privileged user on their box. Linux has the obvious advantage that you can look at all of the source code in the box. The code is looked at by lots and lots of people, and I'm a huge believer in the open source development model. I think it's very effective. I mean, if you can get past all of the flame wars on the mailing list and whatnot,
you don't believe that, like, you know what some people have said, that, you know, free and open source software actually promotes piracy and hacking and all that other stuff.
Open source promotes piracy?
Yeah, piracy, hacking, you know, insecurity.
I don't subscribe to that at all. I think giving users and giving businesses true choice in what they're running and give themselves the ability to audit even at the code level and to modify, you know, what they're running, as long as they stay within, you know, the license, of course. And we don't even want to get into the GPL, and we don't even want to go there right now. But I think Linux probably has the advantage there. I think you're going to see Linux come out as a really rock solid secure operating system in the years to come. It's already, you know, light years ahead of a lot of things, but I think as the code matures, I think as a lot of the Linux culture becomes even more encroached in security. And you got to admit, you know, you look at some of the latest distributions today and compare it to, like, you know, Red Hat 6.2. We've come a long way, baby, as far as security goes. So, you know, I don't know. A lot of people say, well, you know, having the source gives you the opportunity to look at the code to find, you know, bugs and easily write exploits. Well, that's one side of the coin, right? Because the other side of the coin is that, you know, the good developers can go through, find the same thing and get it fixed and roll out an update, lickety-split through, you know, the mirrors and whatnot. And you know, as far as zero-day exploits go too, something else I was going to mention, with Linux and Windows and whatnot, but a lot of people, and I hear this a lot, especially at conferences, and I don't know what gets people thinking like this, but a lot of people are saying, well, because we have the source to you know, Linux, because we have the source to all these, you know, GNU applications and all of that, it's really easy to find exploits and create, you know, zero-day exploits for these vulnerabilities, and we'll always stay ahead of the developers. You know, whereas, well, Windows is closed source and no one can look through it, and the attackers are just getting lucky. Okay, that's a bunch of crap. You can do a quick Google search, for Windows zero-day exploits or Windows undocumented exploits. There are a lot of bugs in Windows that people have found that have even reported them to Windows, to Microsoft, to fix Windows, and, you know, they're still not fixed. So I don't believe that whole mantra that open source promotes, the open source development method promotes, you know, exploits and vulnerabilities and piracy.
Quite the
and
opposite, I would think, I right? The open source development method promotes quicker bug fixes and things like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, look at the Firefox guys, man. Those guys rock. You know, when there's a vulnerability found, it's usually fixed in, what, hours, days at the most? It's amazing.
Well, hours at the most, yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I've seen some that, you know, took a little, which I understand, you know, but yeah, they're just so quick. And now Firefox, you know, when you bring up Firefox, if you have it set to check for updates, I don't even check the Firefox website anymore. Firefox updates itself; it updates all my extensions, and I don't do anything. I'm just running the latest, greatest security. Yeah, exactly. So that's the monkey's opinion.
All right.
And speaking of Firefox and Monkey, have you looked at, is it Sea Monkey? That's what it's called, right?
Sea Monkey, the extension, the extending of the Mozilla project with Mozilla.
No, you know what?
It's a rewrite of the Mozilla project, right?
Well, is it? I don't know if it's a complete rewrite, but aren't they just taking over from where the Mozilla project left?
No, I think Mozilla project is done, and I think these guys are redoing it.
I know
They're going with the all-in-one suite, right?
Right. They're continuing on with the all-in-one suite.
Gotcha. Okay.
I wasn't aware that they double checked that.
You know, I'm trying to find it.
I didn't know that they rewrote the whole thing. I thought they were just
it's a new implementation or something.
It's Sea Monkey Project Community Effort Delivered Production Quality Release Code derived from the application formerly known as Mozilla Application Suite.
From, there you go.
Whereas the main focus of Mozilla Foundation is on Mozilla Firefox and Thunderbird, our group of dedicated volunteers works to ensure that you have everything but the kitchen sink and have it stable enough for corporate uses.
Yep, that's right. And it's fast. Like I said, if you guys haven't checked it out yet, you should. It's pretty neat. I don't like your mail client. Not as good as Thunderbird, but boy, their web browser is pretty damn quick.
So you're going to run Sea Monkey and Thunderbird on. You'll be back to using like Firefox and Thunderbird then, right?
I'm still using Firefox and Thunderbird. I looked at it. That doesn't mean I run it every day. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's still a little immature, but it really is. It's coming along nicely. It's really quick. I think it's still a little immature yet. And if I really am dying for speed, I'll run like Opera, because Opera is just damn fast. You know, I really don't like Opera's interface all that much either, but it's quick. You know,
right?
You got it going on.
Yeah,
I'm a big Camino fan. I've been using Camino on the Mac OS X for the longest time now, and it's fast and. There's even a nice little, for those of you that are Mac OS X users, there's a really nice, let me see if I can find it here. Let me see. Actually, I think I already told Link about this. There's a Camino plugin set that you can get that gives you a lot of functionality that Firefox does. It's pretty nice.
Now, Camino pretty much it's Firefox for... OS X, right? It's like the Darwin implementation of it kind of thing.
Yeah, Camino started off as this real lean, mean browser. It's been in constant development for a long time. They don't really have frequent, what I would call frequent releases, not as frequent as Firefox, but, you know, it's all based on Mozilla. It's lightning fast. It has some stuff stripped out that, you know, apparently they didn't think it was needed for the speed, but I got to tell you, it's lightning fast, and actually, here's what I was looking for. If you install Cami Tools, it's spelled C-A-M-I-T-O-O-L-S, Cami Tools. Cami Tools gives the community user a lot of the same options that some of the Firefox plugins do, like, HTTP pipelining, proxy pipelining, user agent switching. You can sync all of your bookmarks and whatnot. I'm just looking at some of the other ones here. Save profiles. It's got all the blocking features. It'll automatically update, add server blocks. You can whitelist. It's got flash block. It's a real nice little set of tools. And let me find you the URL on that real quick. Highly recommend it. Here we go. You know what? It's on version tracker. If you go to versiontracker.com and type in Kami Tools, the latest version is 4.4. A must-have for using Kamino.
Yeah, but what is what now? What does Kami Tools do again?
It gives you a lot of the same functionality that the Firefox extensions do.
Okay.
Like all of your, you know, your blocking and things like that. I use it mostly just because I get tired of getting inundated with ads. So I do the ad blocking. I do a lot of the script blocking.
Pop-up blockers. Works great. Crap.
Oh, yeah. I can't stand those.
See, now that we're on the subject of Macintoshes, I just want to say, like,
not for long.
And I know. You just shut up, man.
Apple sucks.
Just shut up. Go, you know, go wax your PC in the corner for a second. I know that when I was on your podcast, I did not have a Macintosh at that time, at least not one that was running OS X. And I do have one now. I've got an Intel Mac Mini. And it's a fairly decent machine. I mean, I like using it except for, you know, a few things that, as a longtime Linux user, I see as OS X flaws, you know. But the one biggest one that I noticed, and I think that you have an Intel Mac, right?
I have a
Mac laptop that's Intel based.
Yeah, I got a MacBook Pro 2 gigahertz. Yeah.
Now, good. And what I wanted to ask you was, don't you see a problem with getting some of the software for the Intel platform because it's not available yet, like natively for the Intel platform? You have to run that Rosetta or some crap like that in order to run some of the stuff, and that makes everything run so freaking slow.
Well, it does and it doesn't. A lot of the common tools software, like, you know, Firefox, for instance, you know, they're coming out with universal binaries, meaning it'll run on the machine, on the Mac, with a PPC processor or the Intel processor.
Right.
Anything that is universal binary runs like, you know, Steve Jobs says, you know, it's like a, what did he say? It was like a fast like butter, knife through butter, something like that. I know he messed it up, but at the presentation it was pretty funny, but it's just like lightning fast. Now, for applications that do not have a universal binary, Apple did the smart thing, and they have this Rosetta. It's literally like a translator. And what happens is you'll run PPC native code. Rosetta will automatically start in the background. It's sort of like the classic OS implementation within Mac OS X, where you can still run your classic programs. So what happens is Rosetta loads up, and it translates, you know, by all of these programs. And one of the best examples is, and one of the few Microsoft applications that I love to death, is Microsoft Office 2004 for the Mac. It's a real solid suite. It works great, feature-rich, real pretty, very, very productive suite. Well, there's no universal binary for it, so I thought, oh, man, this thing's going to be slow as dirt, right? I was shocked because Word, Excel, you know, PowerPoint, not that I use PowerPoint, I use Keynote, but they run just fine. There's not a whole lot of CPU load at all. I was really shocked. And now let's take an app that's really CPU, GPU intensive, like Adobe Photoshop, for instance. There still is no universal binary for Adobe Photoshop, which is one of the must-have applications for a lot of Mac owners who are graphic designers. Well, I tried Adobe Photoshop on my MacBook Pro, and while it ran at an adequate speed for me, I do not believe it would run at an adequate speed for a graphics designer or artist. And I'll tell you how I really noticed the speed was I found this great implementation of the GIMP for Mac OS X called Seashore, and I love this. I've always loved GIMP, and Seashore was a real welcome program for me. Well, if you take an image in Seashore and an image in Photoshop, the non-universal binary version of Photoshop, and you start running filters and just watch them side by side, it's like night and day. you know, Seashore just, or I should say GIMP, just, you know, runs all over it. So, like I said, some programs, you won't even notice they whip Rosetta. Some programs that are real CPU, GPU heavy, yeah, you're going to notice a little bit of slowness until the vendor gets off their butt and releases a universal binary.
Now, what about OpenOffice? Have you tried OpenOffice yet?
You know, I haven't. I haven't tried OpenOffice yet. I use OpenOffice on, I have a Dell laptop running Ubuntu that I'm running OpenOffice on that runs just fine, but I haven't tried it. You know, I know this is sacrilege, but my employer was kind enough to buy a license of Microsoft Office 2004 for my my PowerBook when I had my PowerBook before the MacBook, and I've just fallen in love with it. I mean, the Apple shop at Microsoft, but that sounds weird, doesn't it? The Apple shop at Microsoft, they're writing some really good code. I was really impressed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dan's like that too. He really loves that Microsoft stuff, you know.
Oh yeah,
I love the Apple stuff myself.
He's over there. He rubs himself all over with it every night before bedtime.
How much did you pay for the MacBook Pro, if you don't mind?
Too much.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I actually got an educational discount on it because I am, the periodic college student, as aren't we all. So I think with a gig of RAM and the 7200 RPM drive, I want to say it was, I think I bought iWork along with it. I want to say it was like $2,300. For those of you that are looking at getting a MacBook Pro and you want to get in on the cheap, go to store.apple.com, and on the far right-hand side, you'll see this what looks like a red sign. It's like a red price tag. It says save. If you click on that, this is Apple's refurb section, and they have refurbished 1.83 Intel Core Duo MacBook Pros for $1,699 right now. And they've got 2.0 gigahertz MacBook Pros like the one I have for $2,199. And actually, I'm looking at this here. If I had waited until the refurbs came out, I could have got a 2.16 gigahertz for what I paid for my 2 gigahertz.
Did I have a discount on the iPod condoms that go for $99? That's what I'm interested in.
No, I can't say I've put any condoms on my iPod, but it is in a nice little mesh bag in my glove box hooked up to my my car stereo, so I don't see it a whole lot anymore.
Dan loves the iPod.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I got a question for you about that Intel iBook. I heard somewhere along the line that it will only boot from an HFS Plus formatted media, and that one of the problems of getting Linux installed on there is there aren't any HFS Plus formatted installation CDs or DVDs. Is that true?
You know, that's a really good question. My only experience with running Linux on the Intel MacBook Pros has been through the virtualization software. And hey, here's a good time for me to plug another product that I have nothing to do with, but Parallels. Parallels virtualization software. It's at parallels.com. Man, this stuff is sweet. It's $40. I think you can get a $10. No, I think that's with the $10 discount right now. $39.99, and it will allow you to run, any flavor of Windows, Linux, Solaris x86, whatnot in a window or full screen on your MacBook Pro. I mean, the distribution of Linux actually, thinks, well, it is. It's on an Intel machine. It just happens to be a Mac using, EFI and not your standard BIOS. But has a nice full screen mode, too. And the later versions support virtual desktops where you can flip back and forth. And I actually did this at a conference I was at recently, and I actually had people behind me oohing and aahing because I had Mac OS 10 on one desktop, and with a quick key combo, I flipped over, and there was Windows XP SB2, and I hit another key combo, flipped over, and there was Ubuntu. And they thought that was the greatest thing they'd ever seen.
And how well does that work? I mean, performance-wise. Is there a noticeable hit?
Not at all. I was really shocked at how efficient this Parallels application really is. I was expecting XP-SP2 to be a complete dog. You know, it's not what I would call native speed. You know, like say if you used Boot Camp to dual boot into you know, XP on your MacBook Pro, but it's real close. It's real close. I was actually able to run some Windows security software that I use to do web application testing, which is a huge CPU hog. I actually ran it in a window against a server, and I flipped back to my OS 10 session and kept right on working. Never felt it.
How about that?
That's interesting, because I've been using, I've been looking at a lot of that stuff lately. I've been using QEMU and VMware Workstation, the new one, was a 5.5 that just came out?
Yeah, 5.5.
And I like them both, but damn, they're like slower than hell, and they're RAM hogs, you know what I mean?
They're RAM hogs, but
huge RAM hogs.
VMware, if you have enough RAM, it runs at almost native speeds.
Yeah, it runs really fast. I noticed that QEMU runs a lot slower. But QEMU doesn't seem to be quite the RAM hog at VMware is, though. It's like a catch-22 almost, you know?
Well, can't you assign the amount of RAM it's using?
Yes, you can.
And you can, but it's still...
And it operates at a 233 megahertz processor. And I'm not sure you can adjust that.
It ran near native.
What, you mean in QEMU?
QEMU, not QEMU, VMware. Yeah.
VMware was near native.
Right.
VMware, you can adjust all kinds of crap on there.
You can also pick the number of processors, too, with VMware, which is kind of nice. So if you got a dual processor box, you can tell it to use one or two procs. It's pretty sweet.
I haven't checked out Zen. Have you guys looked at Zen at all?
No, not yet.
I didn't. I heard there was a live CD distribution that you could run that has like so many virtual machines already on it or something like that. Only I haven't found it yet. So I'm interested in seeing that kind of stuff, though. I'm interested in running that one on Mac OS X as well, but I just haven't gotten around to it yet. Virtualization seems to be like, you know, a big topic.
Yeah, it's taken off now, man.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not as interested in running Zen because that requires you to run the Zen virtualized kernel. So you got to reboot and then you got to run your.
No, not necessarily. I've been reading up on the Zen stuff, and the Zen stuff is included in some of the more recent kernels. Only like the older 2.4.
Yeah.
Well, no, 2.0 stuff but, that you but have what, to what put I'm patches saying is, in, right?
It's if you have a system set up, don't you have to, if you're going to run the Zen stuff, don't you have to reboot into a Zen environment and then run the image? But you can't run, like, the image on top of your existing environment like you can with QEMU or VMware?
You mean have to boot
know.
Into
I
it?
I really haven't.
I was under the impression you had to reboot into a Zen environment and then run your images off of that.
The kernel has to have it enabled by default.
Right,
I know the new version of Fedora Core
QEMU
and SUSE have it on by default, I think.
Right, they have that kernel extension already in there, the new kernels.
Right, but what I'm saying is...
I don't know if you have to do anything extra in order to start it.
I don't think so. I think you just got to download the packages and
fire
it up.
Right, but from what I've read is you got to boot into a Zen environment and then run your images. So, like, on my main workstation there, if I said,
you just fire up a window.
I
want to
play, you know, something like play around with Ubuntu or something. I could do that in QEMU or in VMware, but in Zen, I would have to reboot into a virtualized Zen environment and run the images like that.
So it's not like
I
just
could
open,
be right.
It's not like opening up a window and going.
Right, I could be wrong on that, but that is when I did some brief looking into it. That's what it sounded
gotta
like.
Gotta check it
to
out,
me.
Man. It's interesting stuff, though.
Hell yeah,
Security Monkey. We had a couple questions come in from into our email.
Sure,
people were interested in your opinion on. This comes from Brian. He actually has three questions. One is, he uses a Z modem for file transfers using SZ and RZ commands through SSH. But when he's trying to use RZ from the server and open SSH, a file selection dialog never appears. Is there a secure Linux client alternative?
Ooh, good question.
Wouldn't that just be SCP? Why can't you just,
Yeah, is there a specific reason why he has to use the method that he's using? Does he say? Because, I mean, S-copy
well,
and
prefaces,
even that.
He prefaces his questions with, he works at a web hosting company, and he's been using Windows for his work computer, but he's working on switching to Linux. He needs to find replacements for some of the window programs that he uses. Now, he's talking about using Zmodem for file transfers. That's all he said, and he wants to know if there's a more secure Linux client alternative. And I'm not sure if he means an alternative to OpenSSH or Zmodem.
Yeah, that's a good... I'm not quite sure how to answer his question. I'd be curious to know which specific application is requiring that. I mean, I haven't run into that in my field work at all. I've never seen that.
Yeah, see, now, to me, it just sounded to me like he was asking for, opinions on what a secure file transfer mechanism under Unix would be, and you know that's easy. That's SCP, right? I mean,
yeah,
you can use that under Windows now. So,
yeah, if he's in a, did you say he's in a web development shop?
Right, web hosting company, not
web hosting company. Yeah, you know what? I've been in a few hosting companies, you know, doing evaluations, and you know, almost all of them use shared keys between servers, and they automate all of their file transfers using S-copy, through cron. You know, every night they do their site backups, they do their production rollouts onto customer sites and whatnot. It's all done through S-copy and using shared keys between the two, and it's just a no-brainer. He might want to go through and look up setting up shared keys with Secure Shell between two servers. It's not real difficult at all.
No.
And give it a shot. You know, pick up some Googling on how to go in and edit your cron jobs. You know, the old cron tab, and go to town.
Here's a second question, and I don't know if you're gonna be able to answer this without knowing the actual client, but. He's installed a VPN client, but it seems to time out very quickly if it's not used. His temporary workaround is to ping a URL behind the VPN after he gets it going to prevent timeout. Is there another way to extend the timeout?
I wonder if he's using Cisco's VPN client for Windows. I have the same problem.
It's a VPN. Wait, you know what? Maybe VPNC is Cisco's client. Is that it, VPNC, or is... He says VPNC. He installed VPNC. I'm not sure if that's a virtual the name of it, or he means virtual or VPN client.
Well, VPNC is a client for the VPN concentrators.
That's probably what he means.
Okay, so he's probably using the Linux version, I would guess then. The only thing, I'm trying to remember if the Linux version has the keep alive option on it. Does anybody have it handy to check?
Not me. I don't
anybody?
Even think.
The Linux version of the VPN client?
Yeah, of VPNC. I have the Windows and the Mac OS client here in front of me, but I don't have the...
I've never been able to get the Linux version to actually run, so I couldn't tell you. But I know SSH has keep alive on it, so... I mean, that's what I always tell everybody, right? I tell them to drop the VPN crap that they're running and just, you know, do their crap over SSH, but that's just me.
Yeah, I'm looking here to see if there's a way to configure a keep alive, because it just sounds to me like it's timing out, or something else that's bit me in the butt with Cisco's VPN clients is you run into... a connection scenario with some firewalls where the firewall will automatically close the tunnel for inactivity. And specifically, I've had that problem with, I don't know if any of you have heard of Astaro Corp's secure Linux firewall. Back in the version 4 days of that, we had that problem all the time where we couldn't keep VPN connections alive through those things. And after we upgraded the box to... version 5 and then the version 6, the problem went away. But I don't know if he's behind a firewall or whatnot, or even, here's something else too to consider is load balancing equipment. If he is behind a lot of connections that use, like, say, F5s, routing gear, that's something else to look at to see if, you know, maybe VPN connections aren't, you know, sticky for whatever reason and it's dropping them. But I wish I had more. I will put that on my to-do list of stuff to go look up, though, and I can get back to you guys.
All right, and the final question. Let's see if we can go for 3 for 3 here. Is there a simple, secure Linux password storage program, preferably one that can import tab-denoted files?
Secure password storage on Linux. That's a good question. I always, on my Linux box, and again, this is just because I'm a geek, but, you know, I typically don't keep mine on my Linux box. I use my Treo with secure password storage. As far as, I don't know, you could do something as simple as you could, you know, put it in a file and PGP encrypt it. You could, I don't know, it's a good question. Let's take a look.
Came up with some whoppers there, huh?
Well, there was a program called Pass Reminder for a while, and let me see if that's even in development. Let me see here. Oh, you know what? It still is in development. Let me see if they have a version you can download. Yeah, there it is. Version 0.6.2. There's a Windows installer, a Linux GTK, Motif installer, and they even have it for a memory stick. Look at that. The URL is, oh boy, this is going to be fun. I can see you. It's spelled EYECANSEEYOU .free, FREE .FR.
All right.
And the application is called Pass Reminder. That's the only one that comes to me off the top of my head.
All right, there we go. That answers his questions. Bye, Ben Rev.
So here's a question for you. What exactly do you use, Security Monkey, since you use those big, long, confugulated passwords? What do you do to actually remember all your passwords?
I knew this was coming. I'm a big believer in coming up
with... He writes them all on sticky notes and sticks them on the bottom of his desk drawer, right?
No, I eat the sticky pads. I told you that earlier. Weren't you listening? You know, you stick them in your mouth, you eat them, I digest them, and then they go into your bloodstream, you know, through osmosis. So anyway, seriously, though, what I do is I come up with a key, some type of, you know, mnemonic key that I know that I don't share with anyone else. You know, I use basic substitution. You know, a lot of people just use leet speak, you know, so they figure, well, if my password is cookie, I'm just going to substitute zeros for the O's, ones for the I, threes for the E, whatever. I tend to come up with something that's a little stranger than leet speak. I use a nice mix of capital letters, and there's a sequence to how often I use the capital letters. So just as an example, if you know a dictionary word, a nice long dictionary word that you want to use, like, you know, let's just say you were using craptacular as your password, and I know that every third character in my password is always all caps, and I know that I always use a... Well, you know, I'm trying not to give away the one that I really use here. You know, if you substitute like a capital Z for every time that you use, you know, a particular vowel or something like that, as long as you can remember the method that you always use, you can pick any word, and it becomes a pretty strong password. So that's just what I have always done. I used to tend to use the leet speak passwords just because, well, you know, we encounter them every day in IRC and instant message and whatnot, but a lot of the rainbow table solutions that are out there now for brute forcing password files take into account leet speak combinations. So after I saw that, I thought, I need to come up with something a little better.
So now, have you ever heard have you ever heard like the one up and over cipher kind of thing? It's a really, really old Unix hack for coming up with a password. Like you take a passphrase, a sentence, or a couple words, or something like that, and you use one key up and over. I've been doing that for like, you know, 10 years or some crap, 15 years, you know, for passwords.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, there's, on top of that, you know, I had a friend once that would like to take popular songs that he knew all the words to, excuse me, and he would take a letter from each of the words in the first verse of the song, and that's how he always remembered his password. Now, this is kind of a funny story, but this is the same guy that really loved music, and I can still remember this day when he locked himself out of his Windows NT machine because he had picked up a new song on the radio that he really liked, and it was the only one in his head, and he couldn't remember what song he used for his administrator password. So needless to say, he came knocking on my door, "Can you do a password recovery for me?" So, you know, in the NT days, that was a pretty easy process of nuking the SAM file and rebooting, and, oh, look, blank administrator password. Woo-hoo! NT was so secure. Not. One of the for those of you that are really into ciphers, cryptology is sort of a, I guess, a hobby of mine, but I highly recommend a book by Simon Singh. His last name is spelled S-I-N-G-H. He wrote Fermat's Enigma, but the book I'm going to mention here is called The Code Book. It is a wonderful overview of the development and usage of cryptology through time. And it starts off real basic. It starts talking about how, you know, back in the 1500s, you know, cryptological methods were being used to exchange messages between people that were betraying their, you know, governments and people that were going to kill kings and queens. And then they get into, you know, things as simple as a, you know, a substitution cipher or, you know, a Caesar shift cipher. Or the book basically ends with a discussion of quantum cryptography. So if you really want something to bend your brain, that last chapter is good, let me tell you. Guaranteed to have you nodding in about 10 minutes.
Okay, awesome. So here's a test question for you. Everybody wants to make sure you're qualified, you know, to do your security monkey thing. So what I want you to do is tell us what the last cipher actually says on the cryptological...
Cryptos.
Yeah, on Cryptos out in front of the FBI building.
Oh, yes.
The crypto sculpture?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd like to tell you, but I just found out that, you know, they included an extra X, so I have to start all over again.
There you go.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Darn it.
So sorry, man. Yeah.
Well,
I was so close. I was so close, and the bastard put an extra X on the end.
You know, speaking of being qualified and reading your information and judging from your reputation, you're a pretty well-qualified person in computer forensics, at least it sounds that way, and I think that you are. What's your feel for the?
It's all a giant lie.
Yeah. what is your feel for the way that the computer forensics environment is going now? You know, I know some people that are interested in getting into the field, and they went around looking at some of these places that offer courses, and they threw up a test up there, and I was like, I was surprised. You know, I don't know whether this test, that the example test reflects what the actual test is that they're giving, but I mean, it was like stupid stuff. Like, how do you format a floppy with a to make it a bootable system in DOS? I mean, it was like really, really ridiculously easy questions, I thought. To me, that doesn't reflect well on what, you know, the security or the program that they're trying to push here.
Yeah, and you know what? I I would agree with your observation, and I was a staunch opponent of a lot of the forensic courses that were out there until I found one that I actually liked. And when I say liked, I mean I think for someone to get the certification, it shows that they've obviously done some field work, they've obviously used the software, they're aware of the procedures, and they didn't just like go read a book, take a test, and you know, they're Insta MCSE, you know, certified examiner. But I know I plug Guidance Software a lot, but they really do have a great product with Encase, and they have a certification program with it. And when you first look at their certification program, the first thing you notice is, holy crap, the first chapter is nothing but computer hardware components? You know, do I really have to, you know a lot of these really basic things that to us might seem stupid? Like, I'll give you an example. Like, one of my favorite questions was, what do the terms master, slave, and cable select refer to? Okay, so I'm guessing 99.9% of the people listening to this show are just beating their head into the table right now because we've all gone through the pain of using IDE devices. Well, there is a point to going over basic hardware configuration, what makes up a file system, and that is in order to properly look at a situation that you're going into where you know you're going to have to acquire, you're going to have to acquire, you know, a hard drive, a memory stick, anything at all that you're going to get data off of. You're going to go under, you're going to acquire the information, you're going to do an analysis of it, and then you have to present your analysis of these digital artifacts to perhaps someone in law enforcement, maybe to a consultant, maybe to a jury. If you can't get up there and explain the process of what happens when you type in a specific command, what parts of the computer are affected, and what caused the output to occur that did occur, you know, a prosecutor is going to have a field day tearing you up on the stand. And, you know, the one trait that a lot of geeks have is that they know a little bit of stuff about a lot of things because of their vast exposure. And there are some people that know a lot about little things. And these are the kind of people that can get burnt in that type of situation. And I'll give you another example here. Where is that one question in here? Okay, so here's a great example. You are investigating a seized computer. You recover a document containing potential evidence. Encase reports that the file system on the forensic image of the hard drive is FAT, meaning file allocation table, of course. What information about the document can be found in the FAT on the media? Now that's the key. And your choices are name of the file, date and timestamps of the file, starting cluster of the file, fragmentation of the file, ownership of the file. And you have to pick all that apply. Now, if you were up on a stand and you had a prosecutor that brought in some computer expert, you know, some, like, just say he hires Steve Gibson to come in and try to give you a bunch of questions to throw you. If a prosecutor asked you point blank what information in the FAT on the media, you know, can be found out about this document, I mean, would you be able to stand there and right off the top of your head tell them? I mean, that's the type of information. I mean, the correct answer, you know, is the third and fourth question, or third and fourth answer. I'm sorry. I'm getting tired over here. It has a starting cluster of the file and the fragmentation of the file. But it's so easy for people to hear that question once and go, oh, that's easy, the name, date, and time. Well, that is something that the prosecutor is going to jump on. And if they can make you look like you're tap dancing up there, there's a good chance that they won't invalidate you as an expert witness. And whatever work that you've done could be in jeopardy. And whoever you're working for is, you know, going to be pretty upset. And that, of course, is in the case where you're being called as an expert witness to defend somebody. Let's just say you've been accused of distributing child porn, and you bring in someone like me to go in and do an acquisition and analysis of hard drive, and I produce a report saying there's absolutely no trace of child pornography on this drive. You know, and of course, the prosecutor, they're convinced that, you know, you did traffic in child pornography, and they're going to do their best to discredit my examination because maybe they have other evidence that's more damning. You know, maybe they found a printout of a picture stuck in the back of a book that was in your office that happened to have been, you know, qualified as child pornography. And it may not even have been your book, you know, but I mean, something ludicrous like that. So, getting back on track with the certification, the NCASE Certified Examiner Program, I mean, starts off with just, you know, the hardware. It goes over acquisition techniques, how to search for data. It really gets into the nitty-gritty. So that's kind of why I'm a fan of that certification. Now, you will find other certification courses out there who, you know, they form their own institute, they form their own, you know, committee or licensing organization, whatever. The quality varies tremendously between the two. And when you're testifying in front of a jury, whether you say you're an NCASE certified examiner or you're a, you know, licensed, you know, Windows, you know, security examiner, blah, blah, extraordinaire, they don't know the difference, unless they're maybe IT people. They're not going to know. They're only going to know by how well you present yourself and the depth of knowledge and how well you explain that depth of knowledge that you have. So, again, my long-winded response to the question, but I do agree that at first when you look through a lot of these, it seems kind of, you know, inane and useless, and then when you get right down to the whole nitty-gritty of the situation, you realize, oh, okay, maybe I do have to know these things at such a detailed level.
Okay. All right. We actually have to close up here tonight. I want to thank you for coming on.
Okay, anytime.
Thanks, yes, man. Indeed. It was good having you on.
Yeah. Hey, always a pleasure to be on the tech show.
Yes, and, you know, we'll look forward to hearing you on Security Now next week.
Yeah, thanks, Leo.
Yeah.
make sure you buy a copy of SpinRite, because that's how I pay for my website.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I am going to be looking forward to is the next release of the Security Monkey podcast in the following week, and that's great that you promised and you've committed. And what was that? You said that if you're not, you're going to each give each one of us a Roscoe of our own.
Yes, that's what I said. And unfortunately, what I meant was a 12-inch tall doll of Roscoe P. Coltrane.
Oh, there
so,
we go.
Some on eBay.
Enos, you dipstick.
All right. Pat, we got a... I don't know if you want to do some Frapper shout-outs.
There's not many this week. We've got Jafala 314 from Prescott Valley, Arizona. We got Chen Levy from Israel. We got Mahalo from Belgrade, Serbia. And we got Frank from Spartanburg, South Carolina.
That's it?
That's it for that. Next week, we're going to have... Maria Winslow, the author of The Practical Manager's Guide to Open Source. In other words, how to get your manager to try out open source software. And what else? I learned one thing.
You're not going to pay a lot for that muffler?
No, what I learned is...
Nobody
can't
hear
a damn thing.
Nobody can hear that.
I'll crank it up.
Nobody heard that at all.
I don't know what the hell you're doing, Pat, but we can't hear
shit. It was a good try.
I'll try one more time.
Who was that?
That's from Office Space.
Oh, yeah,
that's
I thought
from
it
Office
was.
Space,
yeah, that's
man.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm like thinking, that sounds like something from Office
See,
Space.
Once I heard it, I knew what he was doing. Like, yeah, that's it.
Ooh. Well.
Lumberg.
Thank you very much for both of you guys for being on. And maybe we'll see Link back in the studio one day.
Maybe.
And I want to thank everybody for listening. And
this was episode
one. I will happily bring my mucus in anytime you want to see me.
Yum. Fun with phlegm.
Yes.
Phlegm.
Nom, nom, nom. We can make a sculpture.
Oh, Jesus.
Yum.
All right,
edible sculptures. Mmm.
I'm going to play us out of here.
Are you going to play that song or no?
What song?
It's officially beer o'clock.
You sent me a what?
Indeed. I sent you a private message.
I didn't even notice.
Okay.
We'll play it next week.
No problem.
There we go.
All right. Good night, everybody.
So we can paint anything we want.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
I paint your fine ass. Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.